From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before disruption, grit, and brand building were buzzwords, those were concepts driven by rare original thinkers like Michael Kohls. Kohls and his partner turned an $8,000 investment and a shop at the Perimeter Mall into $100 million in sales as the American Cookie Company. Kohls went on to run for office, turn Caribou Coffee around, and become a record-breaking endurance cyclist. It's a success story with some devastating disappointments, a variety of crashes, and many opportunities to pick himself up and get back in the saddle, in his case, on a racing bike. It's told in Michael Kohls' book, Time to Get Tough, How Cookies, Coffee, and a Crash Led to Success in Business and in Life. And Michael Kohls is with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here with you in person.
So your approach to many of the challenges in your life, you compare it as David and Goliath struggles. Why does that story speak to you?
Well, I guess I'd have to go back. My dad went bankrupt when I was 10, and he basically lost everything. My life was kind of turned upside down, and I guess even at a very young age, I started looking at people who have overcome adversity. Because for my dad, it was very serious, but I was a kid, but I knew my life had changed. And so the story of David and Goliath, which is probably the first story I ever heard about overcoming adversity, for a lot of people, it was the fact that David stepped into the valley with this enormous giant who had armor and weapons and was able to defeat the giant, in fact, kill him. But for me, the takeaway of the story was always that David had the courage to step into the valley without knowing what the outcome would be.
I think people would look at your life and think, super successful guy, but beneath that, there were many disappointments, many false starts, missed opportunities, and defeats. What kept you stepping into the valley?
Honestly, there's a great scene in a movie called The Cinderella Man, where James Braddock becomes the heavyweight champion of the world, and he'd been lost for a long time in not being able to basically fight his way out of a paper bag. And they asked him in a press interview before he was about to fight for the championship, what's happened, Jimmy? Why are you better? And he basically says, you know, he starts making the normal excuses about why he wasn't fighting well. And then he finally stops and says, I now know what I'm fighting for.
Well, let's hear from that. We've got a scene from the film Cinderella Man. He was played by Russell Crowe in the movie.
Hello, Jake.
It's been a while. What's changed, Jimmy? I mean, you couldn't win a fight for love of money, right? I mean, how do you explain your comeback?
Well, you know, the truth is, Jake, for a number of years there, we was fighting injured. You know, I broke my hand more than once. I got in a car accident one time, was on the road, and I had to get that fixed. I had a run of bad luck. And this time around, I know what I'm fighting for.
Oh, yeah? What's that, Jimmy?
Milk.
Milk?
Milk? Michael Kohls, what does that mean?
Well, for me, it was after my dad lost his money and we wound up moving to Florida, we moved, the four of us, my sister, myself, and my mother and father, to a 300-square-foot, one-bedroom apartment in Miami Beach with no air conditioning. It was a reality check because it was the first time I realized we were pretty poor. And I think what always has driven me to get back up is never wanting to have that feeling again.
Well,
it wasn't even necessarily about not living that way. It was the feeling of living that way.
So if we go back to the David and Goliath idea, was your father a giant in your eyes before that?
Yes, and the disappointment in my father's eyes, because he was never able to recover, both gave me sadness and encouragement.
Well, this was when you were just 10 years old. His business failed in Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo, New York, yeah.
And you had to give up your dog. There's this vision of you in the book. It's so sad. You know, you're looking into the basement window at a house you just moved out of. What were you seeing there?
Well, it was just, again, it was that even then at that moment, it was the reality was not necessarily as clear as it became later, but because I was still in a bit of a bewilderment as to what had happened. Because when you're a kid that age, you don't understand what bankruptcy is. But I knew I literally came home from school and my dog was sitting next to my red wagon then in my wagon with her food and her ball. And my parents basically said, we're moving and you have to get rid of the dog. And they had arranged for one of our neighbors to take the dog. And for me at that moment, I guess that's all that mattered to me was the fact that I had to give up that dog.
Yeah. Well, you turned it around quickly, stepped back in, started buying other kids' toys and selling them at a markup. You had a leaf and snow removal business. Looking back, what do you think your father did not get about business?
Listen, my dad started working when he was 11 full-time. He had to drop out of school to support his family. And the fact that my father had ever made it into being what I would say an upper-middle-class family would have been a miracle in itself. And I think that when he had a fire, I mean, he had a business, but then he had a fire and no insurance because the business was pretty new. Mm. And it was the fact that he had no insurance that caused him to eventually go bankrupt. And I think he just lost his mojo. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I mean, I think it was so devastating for him to have to kind of go back to where he was. And he just couldn't get back on his feet again. But well, he always encouraged me.
He did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My dad was the biggest believer in the American dream of anyone I've ever known. And even with the kind of life he wound up leading, he always believed that you could do anything in this country if you put your mind to it and put hard work behind it.
Well, the hard work came for you in Miami. You started working for just a guy who sounds like an extraordinary character named Irving Settler. This was about 13?
I was 13.
1957. Yeah. Dorwin's Men and Boys Apparel Shop. First, we've got to hear the story of why it was named Dorwin's.
Well, Irving was, you know, the original bootstrap guy. I mean, he started working in that store. And eventually, when the owner of the store wanted to sell it, he bought it. And Irving had to put everything on the line to buy it. He really didn't have any money. And so the name of the store at the time was Windsor King of Slacks, and it was big block letters. And he couldn't afford to buy a new sign, so he rearranged Windsor to be Dorwin's. And I actually didn't even find that out till I was working for him for a year. I was like, what is Dorwin's? Is that like a family name or something? And he gave me that story. And again, it was a great lesson. Almost when you think about it today, where they talk about lean startups, man, that was about the beginning of a lean startup.
We're learning about the life of Michael Coles. He's an ultra-successful entrepreneur. He's an endurance athlete. No Ivy League pedigree or name school MBA, but a lot of things to learn from. In his new book, Time to Get Tough, How Cookies, Coffee, and a Crash Led to Success in Business and in Life. So by 16, you were a buyer, you learned how to tailor suits, and you learned about the entire supply chain. That was something you learned from him, everybody's job. How far did you carry that in the rest of your life in business?
Well, a long way, because I left Miami, I wound up becoming a manufacturer's representative for a clothing company. And the fact that I knew so much about all these different aspects, a lot of times when I go, especially these small towns, to try to sell, I mean, there was always issues with small independent retailers.
Right.
And this is not in the book, but the bottom line is a lot of times I'd walk in, they were having a problem. The person that was supposed to do their windows didn't show up. Their tailor didn't show up. And I would literally step in for some of these accounts and do those things for them, which enamored me, of course, to the account. I wound up getting more business, so it was a good thing to do. But later on, when I started my first manufacturing company right before the cookie company, the Great American Clothing Company, coincidentally.
We see a theme here.
Yeah. We started that company, and we could not find a pattern maker to make some of the samples of the merchandise we were thinking about doing. And I went into the back room and was able to make the samples for our first line of clothes. And then we brought in a tailor who could put everything together. But literally, I made the samples. That would never have happened. I don't know what we would have done, because we could not, back in that day, here in Georgia, it was the pinnacle of clothing production. Those pattern makers were all busy.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up doing it. So it helped. It definitely helped. But more important than anything was that Irving really taught me that, and I probably didn't learn this lesson except later in my life the hard way by not taking his advice, which was, You don't have to be an expert in every part of the business, but you have to understand every part of the business so that you can ask the right questions.
Well, and another important lesson for you, early on, you had to fire a friend. You know, this is one of the ways that we think of leaders in business is, you know, they're streamlined and singular a vision and pursuing their path and everybody else falls to the wayside. What did this lesson mean to you?
Well, it was another lesson that Irving taught me, which was, one, you have to take responsibility for the people you hire, because he didn't let me off the hook. He made me do it, and it was my best friend. Mm. But more importantly, he taught me the lesson that if someone is in a job that they can't handle, you cannot wait. You're doing a disservice to them, and you're doing a disservice to the company. And Irving taught me early on that the company's responsibility is to all of the people that work there. And you have to make some tough decisions because they're depending on you to make the right decisions if you're the owner of the business. And so I learned to move people out very, very quickly if they weren't doing or capable to do their job.
I'm imagining you, man about town, teenager about town in Miami, right? Wearing great clothes. You bought a car. But this is when you're in school still. So what did you miss out on as a child because you pursued that path?
Well, I was not a very good student. I had been a good student until I was about 10. But when I had to start working as much as I did, I was basically a failing student. Mm. I would eke by each year, but I had no time to do homework. I missed out on everything. I never played any sports. I never got to play sports. I didn't get to go to prom. You know, I just didn't get to do those kind of things. I just didn't have the money or the time to do a lot of that. My senior year of high school, when I went to live with my brother, that kind of got turned around. Even though I was working a little bit, I got to participate in sports, which I was never very good at, and because I had no background in it, I guess. That's a good excuse. Or is that I had no athletic ability. It was one of the two.
Well, you disproved that much later.
And I did turn my grades around. I wound up getting to live with my brother in Rockport, and I wound up becoming an honor roll student and had prepared to go to college. The things that I missed, you know, I think a lot of it got made up in my senior year. But, you know, people always say to me, well, what if you could do something different? Well, I don't know, because what would the result have turned out to be?
I'm wondering about that. You know, you've made a great name for yourself, made a great business for yourself. And from what I read in the book, it really mattered to you to be a full person. But looking at your kids, you know, you've had children. Do you have any of that idea that, you know, you need to go through some hard knocks in life in order to be a person who understands the world?
If my dad had stayed in that kind of upper middle class and I had had a different bringing up, I don't know that I would have wound up having the determination that I have today. I certainly wouldn't want to take a chance that that would have happened. And so my children, I've really tried to raise them with a real sense of value about, if you're successful, no matter what your degree of success is, you've got to be a good citizen of your community and that you've got to give back one way or another. You know, I have to talk about the three W's in the book, work, wisdom, and wealth, and that if you don't have money, that's fine, work. If you eventually have a little bit of money, don't just write a check. The things you care about, try to help them, because most nonprofit organizations can never afford the kind of talent that successful people can bring to that organization and help them transform themselves.
My guest is Michael Coles. When we come back, we're going to hear about a little bit more about the 70s, the wide lapels, the wide ties, and of course, cookies. After a few financial crashes, of course, we're going to talk about the physical crash that turned his life in another direction. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Michael Coles' name is familiar to many Georgians. He is co-founder of this $100 million company based originally in Dunwoody.
Great American Cookies has a fun and delicious answer for every occasion.
What do you want your cookie to say?
Good luck.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy anniversary.
Now that's a Texas-sized cookie.
So, what do you want your cookie to say?
Great American Cookies has a fun and delicious fresh-baked cookie cake for every occasion. Great American Cookie Company in a mall near you.
He is the Coles of Kennesaw State University's business school and the man who took on Newt Gingrich in a run for Congress. But you may not know his rags-to-riches story. Quite literally, his father was a rag merchant. Michael Coles recounts his history in Time to Get Tough, his new memoir about cookies, coffee, and a crash, and how that all led to success in business and in life. So, Michael, you describe in the book a number of different decision points or junctures in your life. There was an acceptance of your father's bankruptcy, and another in 1972 when you tried your hand at your own business, Pantomime, and some big advance marketing in Atlanta. And it didn't work out. So what happened and what did you learn?
Well, I broke Irving's probably most important lesson, which was you don't have to be an expert at every area of the business, but you certainly have to know the right questions to ask. You know, one of the things I always say is that, you know, by the time I was 30, because I had to start working when I was so young, I thought I knew all the answers. And it turned out I did know all the answers. My problem was I didn't know all the questions.
Hmm.
And in 72, when I started this business, the business was really rocking along, but I was not paying attention to the financial end of the business in understanding profitability of the business. And by the time I got caught up to where we were at, it was really too late. And so I lost the company, went bankrupt. And for about the first, I would say, 3 months, I did what a lot of people do, is I blamed everybody around me that was running various areas of the business. And then I'd say about 90 days out, I finally realized that the person that really was at fault was me, and that because I had not taken that lesson from Irving, but even more importantly, I had to take responsibility for the fact that at the end of the day, it was my company. And so at that point, I made a decision, which was that I would probably go back into business, and I would probably still make a lot of mistakes, but I was never going to make those mistakes ever again.
Well, asking those questions, you took inspiration to create or to switch, let's say, from the Great American Clothing Company to what became the Great American Chocolate Chip Cookie Company. What was the inspiration there?
Well, I was in the clothing business still, and my kids were still pretty young, and the clothing business, which I moved to Atlanta because this was the hub, it was all moving to Asia. My kids were young. I was missing a lot of things, traveling 3 days a week, but now I would have to start traveling probably 3 weeks a month, and I didn't want to do that. And so I wanted to find something that could keep me closer to home. I saw a cookie store in California, and I came back and basically told my wife, Donna, that I don't know what we're going to do for the rest of our lives, but while we're trying to figure it out, let's open, and the key word here is a cookie store.
Hmm.
I figured we might have a couple in Atlanta, and you know, but then I would really find what I was going to do to really make a real living for our family.
So you started working with your friend Arthur Karp,
right?
And this is in 1977. But give us a sense of the whole business climate in the 1970s. We don't think of this as a strong entrepreneurial time.
Well, it was people always ask me when's the right time to open a business. This certainly was not it. Interest rates were extraordinarily high. There were gas lines and gas shortages. It was a very bad time in America. I mean, Jimmy Carter was president, and he basically, the first time I think any president has ever gone on television and just basically said, the threat is that the next generation will not do as well as the current one. Mm. And or it was called the malaise. And but, you know, 21% interest rates, we didn't have a lot of money, and we just felt like we had a better way of doing a business that had started a couple years before. And we didn't have a great beginning, but we did get a great location at Perimeter Mall. But that opening day,
mm-hmm.
you know, when people always hear the fact that we invested $8,000 and grew the company to $100 million, they always think that everything must have just gone really smooth from the very beginning. And one of the stories, of course, is the great story, which is funny now, wasn't funny then, was that on that opening day, we put our first batch of cookies in the oven, 300 cookies at 350 degrees. And when the bell went off to look into the oven to take the trays out, we realized we had no pot holders. And we didn't have any rags in the store. We had no napkins. We virtually had no way to get the cookies out of the oven until my partner, who ran out to find something. But by the time he came back, the cookies had already virtually gone from golden brown, beautiful cookies to being on fire on the trays. Smoke was pouring out of our oven to our neighbor next door because we're in a combined air conditioning system. People running out of the store screaming because they thought the mall was on fire. And the guy that gave us this big chance, Jeff Weil, who was the mall manager, just looked into the store. Fortunately, the gate was down and just asked the simple question, is this what it's going to be like every day? And the lesson I like to talk about in the book is that I had researched the cookie business for almost 8 months. I had done everything, researched every possible thing. I had all the right equipment. I knew exactly the kind of people we're going to have to hire. I knew how to build the store. Everything that you could plan for, I thought I had planned for. And the one thing I forgot was a $3 set of pot holders that could have put us out of business. And so what I try to get across in the book throughout the whole book is this. Success is not on what you plan for. It's how you deal with the unexpected. Mm. And we dealt with it, opened the next day. And
it ultimately drove customers.
Oh,
but I guess you wouldn't really recommend this for startups.
You know, in some ways, you know, we didn't give up. First of all, we couldn't afford to give up because we had everything on the line. But the great thing about it was people were talking all over the mall and around the neighborhoods where people came from after seeing our flyers where we said we'd give away free cookies. That probably that day before we opened, probably had 100 people standing out in the mall waiting for free cookies. The next day, we probably had 300 people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because when you're writing about this, you came back from that trip from San Diego. You talked to the manager. You know, he was spending $6 per cookie and selling them for 30 cents, which seems very low right now. But Arthur Karp, your friend, and his wife had been thinking about the same thing. You used your grandmother's recipe, I think, for the cookies originally.
Great-great-great-grandmother's, yeah.
And you had read about some brothers who did this business in an in-flight magazine. So I'm just wondering about, as you look at this universe, do you think of these things as coincidences? Do you think of them as signs pointing the way? Or, you know, just a, I don't know, was this fated?
Well, I don't know. You know, I have literally looked back at that because on the way out to San Diego on that trip, I read about Famous Amos in the newspaper. He had just sold his company. And then when I got to San Diego, I saw this cookie store in the mall. And then on the flight home, back in the day when the airlines used to let you read magazines, I picked up this People magazine and had these two or three young guys, I can't remember, that had opened this place called I don't remember the name of it. It was like the Chipyard. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was the Chipyard. They had opened to start money for college. And it was like, why is this cookie thing keep coming at me? And so that's why I decided when I got off the plane until we figured out what we would do for the rest of our lives. It seemed like someone was saying to me, open a cookie store.
Well, I'm also thinking that somebody who had an MBA from a fancy business school might be running numbers and think, I mean, you obviously did a lot of calculations, you figured these things out, but there's a difference in applying things to a data-driven world and a gut. Was it your gut?
Well, I would say this, that I think the reason we did so well is because we did not come out of the food business or out of the bakery business. I was basically a retailer since I had been a kid, and I approached this business. We could have just as easily been selling blue jeans and shirts in those stores in the way it was merchandised and the way we sold things. And I think because we took such a radically different approach to the business is the reason we succeeded. I think the fact that we didn't know anything about how to sell food was a big advantage. And the principles that we use to build the cookie company are the guiding principles that every successful retail business has ever built, used to build their business.
It's still a huge gamble at the Perimeter Mall, not the most popular mall at the time, certainly. There's a terrific story of you guys stalking the manager at the mall to try and get in. What happened there?
There were not that many cookie stores in the country. There might have been a few hundred at the time, but, you know, scattered when you think about how many malls there are. But nobody believed that you could sell enough cookies to pay the rent in a major mall. And so Jeff Weil, who has become a very good friend, had just taken over Perimeter Mall to turn it around because it had been devastated by the opening of another major mall very close to it. And so he was brought in as new hotshot manager. And when I think back about the fact that Jeff took this chance on the fact that we were two guys, no experience in the food business, very little money, and there were already three major cookie companies, one with almost 100 stores and two with almost 50. The fact that he gave us a lease in a business he didn't even believe in is just absolutely astounding to me today. And he would meet with us. And so we did stalk him. The day before, we figured out that he brought a thermos of coffees before the days of coffee shops into the office. And we went to his office at 8:30 in the morning. And as the receptionist said, well, Jeff's got a busy day. I don't think he can see you. We said, we just need 5 minutes. And she said, well, I don't think he'll be able to fit you in. We said, well, that's all right, we'll wait and see. And we sat down. And what she didn't know, we knew, is that he would drink that thermos of coffee. And eventually, he was going to have to go to the bathroom. And so the bathroom was on the outside of the offices. And so we stalked him until he eventually drank that thermos. And we just asked him for 5 minutes. And, you know, he was a great guy and is still a great guy.
My guest is Michael Coles, who started the Great American Cookie Company at the Perimeter Mall in Dunwoody and grew it into a 400-store business. Just part of the story told in his book, Time to Get Tough. But after success with this and even contemplating building another store, just 6 weeks later, a terrible motorcycle accident. What happened on that August night?
So I was left the store. Everything seemed to be going great. We didn't have to go hat in hand to try to get locations. We had mall developers and mall managers offering us space. We had people applying for franchises, even though we weren't selling them yet. Everything that you would think would be there was there. And 6 weeks after we started the company, I was riding home on my motorcycle, my rear wheel locked up. The road was wet. The motorcycle went out from under me, and I went headfirst into a telephone pole. Mm. And when I came down, I was unconscious. And when I woke up, I was in a hospital here in Atlanta with two doctors standing over my bed, basically saying, you're going to live, but you'll probably never walk normally again. You'll always need some type of aid, either canes or crutches. And considering the alternative, not waking up at all, you know, at the time, that sounded okay. But about 9 months after my accident, I had an incident with my daughter, Taryn, who was 3 years old at the time, who basically, I was on two canes, and she asked me to race her to the mailbox. We were on a very steep hill, and I figured even on two canes, I could beat her up the driveway, but I'd never tried to run. And when I tried to run, the pain was excruciating. And it was the very first time since my accident that I realized I was disabled. And I began to make excuses to her. And the hardest part was when she realized what was happening at three, she started making excuses to me like, you know, Daddy, we don't have to run. I'm really tired today. Oh. And it about killed me. Oh. And so when I went back in the house, I said to Don, I can't spend the rest of my life.
This was your way.
Living this way. And I've got to try a different type of rehab because it's been 9 months. And so I developed this self-style rehabilitation program that eventually took me from a stationary bike to a regular bike. And at the same time we built the cookie company to its national success, I not only learned to walk again, but set three world records riding across the United States on a bicycle.
Well, I'd love to hear more about that story. But first, to look at that crash, you opening up this other store, Greenbrier store, one in Columbus, Maryland. So a whole new ballgame looking at national scope. And you're hobbling onto planes, you know, with your two canes initially to go up to Columbus. But you reflect on this crisis, that crash, as a key to your success. Why?
Well, first of all, learning to walk again at 33 learning to walk again at any age would be very difficult. But at 33, it was very, very painful to learn how to do it. And when you have to dig deep like that to keep going, you find all kinds of other strengths. And the other thing that happened is that all my ideas about what else I might do went out the window mm-hmm. the day of the crash. Because you can't, back in those days, coming to meet someone about taking over a company or—
You couldn't even drive, right?
Well, I couldn't drive. I had to be driven everywhere. And anybody that was going to offer me a career would have second thoughts about somebody hobbling around on either canes or crutches or in the early days of it on a walker. And so I found myself, I had to focus on this business because this was it. This is what I was going to have to do.
So an absolute conviction at that point in your life. And especially given the story that you just told us about your daughter, you had a young daughter watching her father suffer. What did that mean to you as the son of somebody who'd watched his father really fail?
I don't think any of my three kids, Taryn, of course, who was right there at the moment that happened, I don't think that anyone could ever, they would ever say to you that there was a time in my life where they ever saw me defeated, even though there were plenty of defeats, because I tried to share with them in anything that was a setback what positive outcome could come out of it. And the fact that I started riding that bike, which was about a 45-pound Schwinn, and because I wanted to be able to spend time with her, I put her on the back of the bike, and she was, you know, three. She still weighed a lot. Not a lot, but a lot on a bike. And so we shared a lot of that rehab together, and I think that perseverance that all three of my kids saw, because the rehab now sounds like it was probably really easy again. Same thing, the cookie story about almost burning them all down is funny. I think the rehab stuff was very painful. A lot of it's encouraging now, makes you feel good, makes me feel good, but it was rough. It was very rough going during that whole rehab period.
My guest is Michael Coles. His book is Time to Get Tough. He is co-founder of the Great American Cookie Company and a world record-breaking endurance athlete. We're going to find out more about that when we come back. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. With Michael Coles, he's succeeded in a number of ventures, clothing sales, cookies, high-end coffee shops, banking interests, and he's also a world record-setting endurance athlete. And despite so much success in his many ventures, his new book, Time to Get Tough, How Cookies, Coffee, and a Crash Led to Success in Business and Life, doesn't read like a how-to guide for aspiring entrepreneurs. Although there is a deep repository of lessons for them, it's also a story of determination and focus that has made him a really popular public speaker. Let's go back to that story. You couldn't really walk, but you started riding a bicycle. How did you start?
Well, I used to run before my accident. I was a runner for aerobics. And when I couldn't run anymore, and I knew I was not going to be able to run anymore, I got a stationary bike. And at first, I couldn't even make a full rotation. I would have to take my legs out at different points, one leg or the other, because they wouldn't bend enough to go all the way around. But once they did, and once the weather in Atlanta, especially in the springtime, turned so beautiful, I wanted to be outside. And so I found this Schwinn, which I had to clean off because it hadn't been used in years. And I started riding around the neighborhood, and it was really tough. I mean, I got on the bike the first time, and I didn't realize, you know, it's like when you're in a car, you don't realize uphill and downhill so much. But we had a very gradual downhill to the corner, and I thought to myself, hey, this is pretty good. I'm actually doing okay. And then I made the turn. I'm still a little downhill. And then I went down the first hill and had to go up the first hill, and I couldn't get up the hill. I just couldn't do it. I had no strength. And I got off the bike quickly because I was afraid I was going to fall over. And so I had to set these intermediate goals to eventually get my full strength back and full stride and being able to ride a bike. It took quite a while. And I think that's one of the things I like to say to people is that, you know, it's great to have a big goal, but you better set some intermediate goals, because if you set your goals too high where they're so out of reach, you'll just give up and not even think about trying to complete it. And so for me, you know, this became a different thing for me, was setting these intermediate goals. Some of them were just be able to get up that first hill, which was only a half a mile from my house. Mm-hmm. And then the next one's try to get to the corner, which was a mile point two from my house. And then from there, and I learned that lesson pretty well in my four crossings of America on a bicycle. That came in pretty handy sometimes when you're pretty tired, pretty devastated, your body is quitting on you. You can't make the goal be a state line anymore. You can't let it be a county line. You can't let it be a city limit. Sometimes it's one telephone pole to the other.
Yeah, so adjusting those goals,
exactly,
too. Because I think a lot of people would say, okay, I'm going to start a small goal and riding my bicycle. You were like, I'm going to ride across the country. From the Savannah Courthouse to that San Diego Mall where you first saw people lining up for cookies. It's an amazing series of stories here about endurance. That's where the title of the book also comes from, Time to Get Tough. What was that?
So in 1983, I set out to break my record that I had set in 1982. And I was, that record was 15 and a half days. And I set a goal to go right across the country in 10 days or less. And I was on a sub-9-day record. I was less than 500 miles from San Diego. I got blown off my bike by a dust devil, which is a little dwarf tornado. And as fast as I was going down, I knew I was not going to get back up, because it was like a 70-mile-an-hour wind that just knocked me off the bike. I broke my collarbone. We had to go back to this hospital in Cochise Hospital in Arizona. And I tried to get back on the bike. It was just way too painful. And then I finally gave in to the pain shot, because it was very, very painful. It was a complete break of my collarbone. I came down the next morning and announced to my crew and my wife that I would do this one more time. And so I came back to Atlanta, went to see my orthopedist, and I said to him, I was in a figure eight brace, and I said to him, when can I start training again? I'm going to do this one more time. And he said, as long as you don't put pressure on your shoulder, you can start today. He said, I would recommend you start on a stationary bike. So I went back, and here we were again, you know, starting all over. I tried to get on the bike, and I couldn't get on the bike because I couldn't hold the handlebar to put my leg over it. So I had to get a stool to climb onto the bike, almost the way you would with a horse, I guess. Mm-hmm. I got on the bike, and I thought everything would be fine, but you still have to hold your hands on the handlebars.
Right, so you're using that collarbone, that shoulder.
It was so painful. And here I was, someone that had been, you know, could ride 10, 12 hours without getting off the bike, and here I was trying to go 1 hour on the bike, and I had to keep saying to myself, you can do this, you can get tough, it's time to get tough, it's time to get tough. And I got through the hour, and I got off the bike, and that thing was just ringing in my head, time to get tough. And so I came in days before printers, and my wife and I had to hire a graphic artist who made me up 50 little placards, some 4x4, some 2x2, with just the initials TTGT, and I put them everywhere in my house, in the refrigerator, on the front of the refrigerator, in my car, on my bikes. I gave them to my crew. I put them all over my office. And in 1984, from the time I began training till the time I was setting out, that became the mantra that kept me going. And the most beautiful thing about all this, and I owe this so much to my crew and my friend Richard DeBernardes, when I got to the point where I crashed the year before, which was, by the way, at the exit 666, and we have a photo of that in the book, I was pretty tired at that point. I looked down on the highway, and my crew had painted TTGT on the highway, and on the overpass where the exit was, there was a group of people holding up a banner that said TTGT, and it gave me so much adrenaline to keep going, and that's the name of the book. That's where it came from.
Michael, there are so many people who They, you know, read about mantras. They put post-its all over their house. You know, they remind themselves that they have to dig in and get beyond the stuff that they need to get beyond. But you have to have the will to do it. And it strikes me that there are so many points in this book where something is challenging you and there's a sort of, okay, this you accept, this you change. You know, where is that line for you? Because I'm thinking about in Prevailing Thought now, there's radical acceptance. You know, you can't change this. You can't undo it. So just live with it and learn how to be in yourself. How do you do that?
Well, I'll give you one example. When I took over the film commission, and I don't know how
this is here in Georgia.
Yeah, here in Georgia. When I took over the film commission with no background in the business.
I'm sensing another theme here.
I had my first meeting with the executive director at the time, Greg Torrey, and I don't know where this kind of thought idea came from, but as I was driving to the OK Cafe here in Atlanta, I started thinking about what I wanted to ask him. And typically, what you would do in a business, and the film business is a business, you would ask somebody, how do we get more people to come to Georgia to make films? But when on my way over, I remember thinking to myself, that's the wrong question. The right question is, why does anyone come here in the first place to make films? Because until you figure out why people are willing to trade with you or bring business to the state, you got to figure out why do other people do it? And if you can key in on the key points, like for instance, for film, the biggest reason people came here, they loved coming here. They loved the weather. They loved the people. They loved the food. They loved the Atlanta airport. And so you start building on the building blocks of why people want to be here. Then figure out the other things that you need to bring more business here. And that's what we were able to. And honestly, that is exactly what I did at Caribou. The first day I walked into Caribou, all I could hear was 7,000 stores Starbucks has. How do we get people to come to us? Mm-hmm. And the question became, well, why does anybody come?
This is Caribou Coffee yeah. Company.
Why does anybody come in the first place?
So once you figure that out,
then you can figure out how to differentiate yourself. How do you differentiate yourself from your big competitors? It was no different in film than it was at Caribou. How do we create an experience for customers at Caribou Coffee that will make them want to come back? If we can get them to come in the first time we do our job right, we can get them to come back if we give them a better experience.
That's Michael Coles. He's my guest today. We're talking about his life, really, and the story that is told in Time to Get Tough, how cookies, coffee, and a crash led to success in business and in life. Well, certainly not always, you know, top of the game success, but some great runs. In fact, you got into politics.
I did.
First of all, you were working, Frizzell Miller initially when he was running for governor.
Right.
I got that right. And then decided to make a run for yourself. And who did you decide to take on?
Just the Speaker of the House.
So there you go. Was that Goliath? Newt Gingrich, who was then Speaker of the House?
It was bigger than Newt. It was what I felt was a condition of Congress that was no longer working for the people. And what I wanted was somebody in Washington that would represent the people of Georgia and not care about getting reelected, just getting there and doing the right thing. And I think people struggle today with that as well. I mean, but the point I guess I'm making is that I never expected to ever run. It was definitely a life-changing experience because when you start thinking about the people in need, and I'm going to say this today, is not more than with Newt, but when I ran for the U.S. Senate against Paul Coverdale and I traveled the state and got so involved with veterans across the state, they became the biggest force behind me was war veterans in this country and how the country has just let them down. It still bothers me today, and I still would wish I could have won because that would have been my focus in Washington was taking care of veterans. It's so easy to send people into harm's way and make promises, but when those promises get broke, it's just not right.
It was around that time that you did decide to sell the Great American Cookie Company, what became what
yeah,
it became.
Yeah, it's now Great American Cookies.
Great American Cookies. Then you became, through various machinations, I'll leave that to the reader, CEO of Caribou Coffee. And you walked into with your three-piece suit and definitely did not win people over initially. I wonder what people would say about you as a boss. You know, you talk about the things that you have learned. How would somebody who, working for Caribou, for example, how would they describe you?
I would hope well. I would think that I tried to be a servant leader in talking to people about things that we needed to do, and there was nothing that I was asking anyone to do that I would not do myself. I would say that, I wore a three-piece suit to be a disruptive leader because it was a company that needed shaking up. I didn't really want to wear a three-piece suit, honestly, but I mean, when I saw somebody in the lower level of the building walking around without shoes, I thought to myself, this is not good. And so when I came in to lead the company, I wanted basically the tie to be the disruption, to understand that I don't want you here thinking about playing softball. I want you here to think about customer experience.
You had demanding bosses. Irving was a very demanding boss. You occasionally write about being frustrated when trying to communicate vision in a number of different ventures. But there's no stories of you exploding or flying off the handle. Who are you as a leader?
Well, I guess what it really comes down to is that one of the lessons I learned was that when you are a leader, when you are somebody's boss, let's just call it what it is, if you're somebody's boss, what the words that come out of your mouth don't necessarily sound the same to the person that is a subordinate. And I've had that turn back to me many, many times where I've said something and it was completely misinterpreted because the words are different to people whose life, in a lot of ways, you're holding in your hand. And so in all of the meetings I would ever have with our management team or with other people that were coming in, at the end of the meeting, I would always ask the question, I want to just understand, what did you hear? Tell me what you heard, because I want to make sure that I got my point across in a way that you understand that it's not, because I really believe that unless we're all on the same side of this, we're not going to be successful. People want to know that they're a part of something. And the easiest thing to do is make them feel a part of it by talking to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the time that you've been in business, you know, way back there at Dorwin's with the switched around sign as a teenager and now, a lot of things have changed. But one of them is that, you know, heads of companies used to make maybe 30 times that what their workers did. Now they make 300, 400 times as much. And we have this idea that CEOs are special people. They're just ordained. They deserve it. And obviously, there's a lot of hard work there. But what do you see? These people who are leaving companies broken with hundreds of millions of dollars as their golden parachutes, could that be considered the new Goliath?
People in business should treat the people that work for them fairly. I'm not going to get into whether someone's overpaid or not overpaid, but the real issue is, do the people that are in the company feel that they're being compensated well, that they're being rewarded for the good job that they do? If that's not happening, it doesn't matter whether you pay the CEO a dollar or you pay the CEO $100 million. If people don't feel value, then they are just going to work for a paycheck. And just like the kid that was working at Dorwin's, Steve, my friend who got fired, he was working for a paycheck. I was working in that store with a real passion for what Irving was trying to do. Because what he did is he took what was an old man's store, King of Slacks, and turned it into the best young men's store in Miami at the time. And it wasn't because it was easy. He had lots of competition, but he was passionate about that business, and he allowed me to be passionate about it as well and work side by side with him.
When you were a young salesman, you sat next to a man who you got bumped up to first class on a flight. He told you, take risks when you're young. So are you now that man, you know, dispensing advice to the young and the hungry?
I hope so. I mentor a lot of young people because of my involvement at KSU. and others. Sometimes people even surprise me by saying they think I'm their mentor. I mean, no one ever asked, but apparently I have been able to help them. You know, I think it's an obligation. I was so lucky to find Irving in my life, and I think in a lot of ways he was lucky to find me as well. But I really believe that people should not only find a mentor, but when they make their mark, they should become one. Think about what is happening right here today. Irving's been gone a long time. I went to work for him 60 years ago, and I'm still talking about him today. What a legacy that was for him, and what an opportunity it was for me to have it and also to be able to give it back.
Michael Coles, co-founder of the Great American Cookie Company, a former CEO of Caribou Coffee, and now author of Time to Get Tough, How Cookies, Coffee, and a Crash Led to Success in Business and in Life. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.